The landscape of poverty in America has changed. But the way we think about it hasn't. We picture poverty as inner city decline, soup kitchens, and homelessness. Historically, inner city poverty rates have been higher than the rest of the country, and this is where the war on poverty has focused. We have a picture of the suburbs, too. Middle class households, safe streets, good schools, and jobs. But for years, suburbs have been home to the fastest growing poor population in the nation. Since 2000, the suburban poor population has grown 64%. Today, more poor people live in suburbs than in cities. But our perceptions haven't kept up with these changes, and neither have our policies. Most community-based anti-poverty efforts continue to focus on urban areas. How do we stretch limited resources to create better opportunities for urban and suburban poor? Let's invest in organizations that work region-wide to connect people to economic opportunity. Let's foster new collaborations across city and suburban lines. Let's use limited dollars strategically, generating better outcomes for people and places. Policymakers, funders, and community providers must come together to expand what works. Let's change the way we confront poverty in America. To learn more, visit confrontingsuburbanpoverty.org.
Well, if you came to church today to hear a political message on confronting poverty, you came to the wrong church. We won't be talking about that today. But this video gives us an idea of how we can launch into the future. We've been in a series called One Great Love, Our Heart to Reach the World. And the first week, what we talked about was being a City View Church. We recently changed our name to City View Church. Could you bring this down just a little bit? Why are we City View Church? Because we feel like the scriptures are very clear that we need to love the people in our life the way that Jesus did. And scripture tells us in several different places that Jesus looked out over Jerusalem and he wept over them. He came off the waters one time and looked over the crowd and had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd to lead them. And so what we've decided is that we are going to stop being an internally focused church, and we are going to start being a church that's focused on the needs around us. The number one need around us is the need for Jesus in people's lives. But we have to earn the right to give them Jesus, and so we've got this program called Scotia Cares, and I told you that we were going to be expanding our Scotia Cares ministry. It has been carried on the shoulders of Mr. John and Miss Chris for far too long, and so I told you there were details that I couldn't give you yet, but now I can. We are partnering with Youth for Christ to see teenagers in this area come to know the Lord and loved, and so we've partnered with them to hire Alan Bishop to do that, and then he is also going to take over and help coordinate some of these things for Scotia Cares with Mr. John, so that we can love our community to Christ. We want to be so intent on reaching them with the good news of Jesus. And so our time here is going to grow, but our focus is not on our time here. Our focus is on there. We also said that in the next 10 years, we are going to be a church that has a larger list of people ready to accept foster children than there are foster children out there in the United States. Well, really, Schenectady County, there are 500,000 children who have been taken from their mother and father and need to be put in a home where they can see what real love looks like. And we know that real love looks like the love of Christ. And so we want to equip families to take them on. We're also going to be a church that makes a difference in the 163 million orphans around the world. So we're going to raise money. We're going to bring those kids home. We're going to take trips so that we can bolster these orphanages so that they can take care of these kids. It is an epidemic and it is a crisis that we will be involved in. That's just who we're going to be. Last week we talked about being a regional church, partnering with Pastor Jay's ministry called Renewal Prayer Network to feed into the life of pastors. Being a pastor is one of the loneliest things that you could ever do, because you're constantly working to help people put their life back together. But what about when you're having a bad day? So Pastor Jay has this ministry to feed into the life of these pastors. There are churches all over the area that are competing to get people. We found this out. There are 850,000 people in this region, depending on where you draw the lines. And 2.5% have a biblical relationship with Jesus. So out of 850,000 people, 21,500 people have a biblical definition of a relationship with Jesus. Let's stop fighting over the 21,000 and start fighting for the 830,000 people. That's what we decided we were going to be. So whatever we've got that another church needs, it's yours. Take it. And we're going to work with, and we're going to partner with these churches. Where there are places in this region where there's not a church, we're going to plant one. We're going to put one there. We're going to put a campus of our church one time, at least one time every 3 years, because we believe that God has marked us out to tell people the good news of Jesus. And today, what we're going to do is talk about what God has for us as a nationally minded church. What can we do? We've been doing some really great things on the local level as a church. Great things. The screens were filled up more than one slide the first week, telling you all the things. If you missed it, come talk to me. We'll talk about all the things that have been going on. We've been doing a lot of cool things regionally, but we sent some money to Oklahoma. So really what we've been involved in as far as the nation is concerned is kind of crisis help, which is great. We need to be a part of that. But we are going to talk about this morning how we can be a part of something much larger than us, much larger than crisis. We can get involved in what God is doing. But to do that, we're going to take a look at Isaiah chapter 58. So flip there in your Bible. If you're new to this whole God Bible thing, table of contents at the front of the book, flip it on over to Isaiah, then find number 58. And that's where we'll be, and we'll read. We're going to go through a large chunk of these verses. Last week, what we talked about as far as the teaching from the scriptures is that Paul said to the church in Corinth that I can't feed you deep food because you are of the flesh. And so what we kind of equated that to these days is that we've got a bunch of churches feeding shallow messages that aren't really deep, biblically rich food. And we're not going to be that kind of church, and we're going to partner with other churches to make sure that we stop fighting over people. We've been so worried about getting you to come that to do that, we put on fancy light shows, and we're feeding you these self-help, feel-good messages, and that's not what God intended. God wrote us a book of deep, rich food, and so we are going to be a church that feeds you that. And today, we're going to kind of continue on with that same idea. Thinking about some of the things that we do and why we do them and maybe how God is thinking, maybe that's not necessarily what I want. This may be a text that you've heard before. This may be a text you've actually heard me teach before, but I think that this is a valuable place in Scripture for us to keep coming back to and seeing, checking off. Are we doing what God wants, or are we doing what we want? So we're going to read the first couple of verses. Then we'll talk about it, and then we'll read a few more verses. Chapter 58, starting in verse 1, it says, "Cry aloud and do not hold back. Lift up your voice like a trumpet. Declare to my people their transgressions, to the house of Jacob their sin." And here's what their sins were. It's going to be kind of shocking. "Yet they seek me daily and delight to know my ways. Yet they seek me daily and delight to know my ways." And as I'm reading that, I kind of stop and scratch my head. Because I've been in church for 34 years, and what I've been taught my whole entire life was seek God daily and delight to know His ways. And the word there, delight, if you were to do a word study in Hebrew, it means passionate. So these people, God says, "Isaiah, I want you to declare to the people what they're doing wrong." And here's what it is. "They seek me daily, and they are passionate to know my ways." And I was confused, like, hold up, that's what they tell you to do at church. So maybe we find out that the motivation behind what they were doing wasn't necessarily the best motivation. See, continue in verse 2, "As if they were a nation that did righteousness, and they did not forsake the judgment of their God. They asked me for righteous judgments, and they delight." They're passionate, again, same word, they're passionate to draw near to God. And so I'm thinking to myself, is God mad at me? You know, is God is God frustrated with me? Is he telling Isaiah to declare to Greg his sin? Because I delight to know him. Yes. I seek him daily and I delight. I'm passionate to know his ways. And when we keep reading, what we see is that their motivation behind what they're doing was just to be seen. And then I find out, man, so yes, maybe God is frustrated with me. Why would, because sometimes I get so distracted with doing my job, working for God, that I forget to actually seek him. I get working so hard, diving into the scripture so that I can feed it to you, that I forget to feast on it myself. And so what God is saying to them is, you do all of this, but check your motivation. Look at this. Is there some sort of self-righteous motivation behind? Are you distracted by doing the right thing that you forget to actually want the right thing? Check out what they were doing. Why have you fasted and see it not? This is what they're asking God. Why have we fasted and you see it not? Why have we humbled ourselves and you take no knowledge of it? That's a weird thing to say, right? Why have we fasted? And why are we humbled? I don't know about you, but there are a lot of humble people that I know, and none of them have ever pointed out their humility, right? God, I'm humble, and you're not seeing that. Doesn't that immediately negate the humility that you walk around through life with? Doesn't that say that maybe there's some pride in the way that you're approaching God? You're fasting with a heart of pride, so that people around you see it. And then here's the other thing. We keep reading. Why have we fasted and see it not? Behold, on the day of your fast, you seek your own pleasure and you oppress all your workers. Behold, you fast only to quarrel and fight. There's pride and hatred in the way that they're approaching God. And you hit with a wicked fist. Fasting like yours will not make your voice heard on high. So God hears the voice that comes through a heart of prayer and a spirit of love. Not this hatred and wickedness, this backbiting and the spiting that they're coming to him with. Is such the fast that I choose one day for a person to humble himself? Is it to bow down his head like a reed, to spread sackcloth and ashes under him? Will you call this fast a day acceptable for the Lord? So he wants us to come to him with a heart of humility and brokenness. And what they were coming to him is really celebrating these two rituals that they did. And so we've been talking about this for several weeks, this idea that we come into church and get that Jesus shot, where we get just enough of Jesus to make us resistant to all of him. Where we come in here and we're doing our duty. We're having this one day for a fast, but then we're going to head out back to work tomorrow, and we're going to, you know what? As that Jesus thing starts to wear off, good news, because I've got a plan to go back next Sunday and get a little bit more. Or maybe it starts to wear off because you have a really bad few days at the beginning of the week, and you think, you know what? They keep talking about that prayer service, and I really could use a little bit more of Jesus right now, so I'll scoot in Thursday. Just get a little bit. I don't need the whole dose that you give on Sunday. I just need just a little bit. I need to get me Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So they get just a little bit. And so that is what I think several churches, I'm not pointing fingers at any churches, but I've been a part of some churches where we're not really seeking after God. We are just coming in and doing our duty. We don't delight to know his ways. We delight to make him happy, and we treat him like he's our puppet. So when I do this and I do that and I do this that the church taught me to do, then I can ask God for this and he'll give it to me. This past Thursday in our prayer meeting, we talked about kind of the prayer of the forsaken, walking through the desert where you don't really feel close or near to God. And why is that? Is it something that I've done to do that? Yes, but no. Sometimes God leads us through these times of kind of dryness and barrenness so that we stop trying to control him and we let him be in charge. So instead of saying, okay, God, I went to church this week. I've did my Bible study. I've I got my Bible out every morning, and I read, I prayed three times a day. I don't know which way is east. Is that way? I don't know. I faced the right direction. I did all the right things. And now that I've done those things, my mom's not feeling real good. And so I'd like for you to heal her. I'd like for you to take care of her sickness. My wife is sick today. And so God, could you take care of that? And God's saying, no, no, I'm not your puppet. You don't do this and then this and this and then make me dance. So he leads us through these times of dryness so that we actually, really, genuinely seek him. We try to follow what he wants. And so what we want to do is we want to be a part of planting churches that are life-giving churches, that aren't just about doing all the right things, saying the right things, going the right places, but we want to be a part of people coming in and being a part of something that is life-giving. What is life-giving? I've gone to some trainings from some church planting organizations, and they really found out that the power comes in the adjective for what the church does. Like, all churches have worship, right? There's worship. What is worship, by the way? It's weird. We all think it's music. That's the music time. That's worship. But if you look it up in the dictionary, worship is divine respect or admiration offered to an object of esteem. So it's the attention you pay to something you value. It's the attention you pay to something you value. So is worship music? Yes. Is worship prayer? Yes. Is worship giving? Yes. Is worship waking up in the morning? Yes. Worship is every single thing you do. And so the power comes in more than just worship, but experiential worship. When you worship, are you experiencing anything, or are you just routinely going about singing my songs to the Lord because he loves my voice? I do, but you know, that's what we go through, right? Okay, I did that. Now, praying to the Lord because he likes when we have a conversation. I'm not going to listen to him. Only with God do we consider a conversation a one-way flow of information, right? If I were to sit down with my wife and say, okay, let's have a conversation, and I start talking, and then she starts talking, and I say, no, 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 I'm just going to keep going. I'm not interested in what you have to say. Our conversation is going to be very one-sided and one-way. How well would that go for me? Is that going to land well? Are we going to walk away best buddies? Are we going to walk away and skip hand in hand through a field of daisies because we had that one-way conversation? No. But with God, we expect that to happen. We don't expect to experience his presence because we don't ever sit there long enough for him to talk to us. So experiential worship. All churches have service, you know, service as in serving. But do you have gift-based serving? That's why we have 301. We want you to come in, go through the assessments on the computer, find out who God made you to be, and then live in that. We believe that God made some people to serve right here in the house. And some people he made not to serve in the house, but he made to serve out there. And he's wired all of us differently. And so who has he made you to be? What we want to do, you know, we've talked about these 10-year plans for all of these areas. What we want to do is be a church that is a part of planting churches. Planting churches is a really expensive endeavor. Really expensive. You got to buy all sorts of stuff. You got to rent spaces when you don't have people to come in. So there are organizations that help people plant churches. What they do is they teach you. Church planting is a 90% failure rate. 90% of people who go out to start a church fail. So there are organizations out there that are saying, if 90% of people fail, what are the 10% doing, and how can we teach that? How can we teach people to do that? And then you know what? It takes a little bit of money to get started. So you raise some money. We'll give you some money. We'll get that started. So we're going to be a church that gives to the church planting process. Let's watch this video of the organization.
We plant life. When life comes, everything happens. Now, the story of ARC. In 2001, a group of pastors formed ARC, the Association of Related Churches, to plant life-giving churches across the United States. Greg Surratt, Chris Hodges, Rick Bizet, Dino Rizzo, Billy Hornsby, Scott Hornsby. Since that time, nearly 200 churches have been planted in the U.S. Churches that are making a difference. Churches that are bringing life to cities throughout the country. Some have become the fastest growing and largest churches in America. As ARC has grown, God has added partner churches. And now, God is asking us to think internationally. For the past 8 years, ARC has partnered with Equip, a ministry that trains millions of leaders in more than 140 countries. Together, we're resourcing and encouraging new leaders, church planners, and pastors who are bringing life to their own cities around the world. ARC's lead team has made Equip's ministry a major missions focus. In the years to come, we'll continue to work together, training Equip alumni in church planning, funding new churches, and building relationships with emerging pastors. ARC exists to plant life. In every country, in every city, we plant life.
And so we're going to be a part of that. They said since the beginning they planted, when this video was made, he said almost 200. They planted 83 churches last year, and they're on pace to plant almost 100 churches this year. So the number is going to be, by the end of 2013, 400 life-giving churches have been started because of the faithfulness of churches like ours that says, hey, we got a little bit of money. We don't have a lot. But you know what? We do trust God to meet all of our needs. And so we're going to give to these people because we believe that when Jesus comes into town, everything changes. You know, I heard a guy tell me, it was Dave, the guy from the video doing college ministry. One of the things is it's really difficult to get pastors on board helping out with ministries because they want to know what's in it for them. They want to know what's in it for them. Are some of these people that we do ministry to at the college going to make their way onto our campus? Are they going to come to our church? And if they're not, it's not worth my time or my energy. And Dave's phrase that he says is, when the tide comes in, all the ships go up. Meaning, when the water comes in, all the ships that are in the harbor, when the tide comes in, they all go up. Meaning, when you are faithful to meet God where He is, doing what He's doing, He's going to be faithful to take care of you. But we're not worried about growing a building full of people. We're worried about reaching people. And so here's one thing that you need to know. If people come in here and meet Jesus and think, you know what, I could grow better somewhere else, please grow. Because our aim is to present you mature and complete at the end. And if you can do that better somewhere else, then go there. Do that. And we're going to be okay, and we're going to be faithful to the message that God has asked us to give. So what do these life-giving churches look like? What do they look like? We're going to keep reading here in Isaiah 58. And this is who, for a very large part, First Baptist Church of Scotia, they were these things. And we're going to take the things that they were, and we're going to maximize, and we're going to become that. So starting in verse 6, we're going to read through verse 12. Is not the fast that I choose that we should loose the bonds of wickedness, to undo the straps of the yoke, let the oppressed go free, and to break every chain? Is it not to share your bread with the hungry and bring the homeless poor into your house? When you see the naked, to cover him and not hide yourself from your own flesh. And when you do these things, then your light shall break forth like the dawn. Your healing shall spring up speedily. Your righteousness shall go before you. The glory of the Lord shall be your rear guard. Then you shall call and the Lord will answer. You shall cry and he will say, here I am. If you take away the yoke from the midst, the pointing of the finger, and the speaking of wickedness, if you pour yourself out for the hungry and satisfy the desire of the afflicted, then your light shall rise in the darkness, and your gloom shall be like noonday. And the Lord will guide you continually and satisfy your desire in scorched places. You'll make your bones strong, and you shall be like a watered garden, like a spring of water whose waters do not fail. And your ancient ruins shall be rebuilt, and you shall rise up the foundation of many generations. You will be called the repairer of the breach and the restorer of the streets to dwell in. So what do these life-giving churches look like? They look like churches that loose the bonds of wickedness and oppression. The number one bond of wickedness and oppression is lostness. And so they come in and they proclaim the good news of Jesus, and that you do not have to live like this. We're not better than you. We just kind of met Jesus who can put us all back together, and we want to introduce you. And when you do that, then you start to see that there are problems like the global orphan crisis. You see that there are 21 million people living today in the human trafficking world. 21 million women and children living as sexual slaves. And we can't stand for that. And so we have to do our part to do that. So when that happens, then God's people start to get motivated around something and we start to move. We see the homeless and we bring them into our home. We see the hungry and we feed them. You see someone with no clothes? What does Jesus say? Don't just give them your cloak. Give them your tunic too. That's why when we're doing this coat drive, don't just go into your closet and pull out some ratty old thing that you don't wear anymore because it's all ripped up. Pull out the good stuff. Give them that thing that you love. I'm not saying give them your favorite. But give them something nice, right? Just because they don't have any money doesn't mean they need to walk around in rags. I think God would say, you walk around in rags. You give them the best. Isn't that what Jesus did? You remember the story where he turned water into wine? What did he do? He turned it into better wine than they were already drinking. And they said, no one saves the good wine till last. But they give the good wine first, and then when everyone's had their fill, when everyone's, you know, I'll say it, when everyone's too drunk to know the difference, then you bring out the cruddy wine and you give them that. That's what Jesus said. I don't know if you guys know, but wedding feasts are not like ours. Weddings back then, like whole weeks. It was the whole week. And for you to run out of wine would label you and stigmatize you as the short-sighted family. And so you would, this wedding couple, this couple that was getting married, were set up to live the rest of their lives having a finger pointed at them, that they're the people who didn't even have enough in their brain going on to provide for the whole party. And then Jesus came in and gave them more wine by turning that water into wine than they could ever use. And so what he came in to say is, not only am I going to give you better than you've already got, but I'm going to give you more than you'll ever need. And so why would we give people our junk? Let's give them our nice stuff. Kind of work through that with our kids. You know, when we first adopted our kids, I guess they came into our house as foster kids. We had nothing. We went from being a married couple doing whatever they wanted, whenever they wanted, to having a couple of kids and not enough beds for them. It sure as heck didn't have any toys. But these families, they came together, and this one little boy, he didn't just go through and find stuff he didn't want anymore, but he went through and found one of his favorite toys and said, I bet that little boy would like that. And why can't we have hearts like these kids? We're always worried about our stuff. And so life-giving churches give people the best they've got, trusting God to take care of it. This church, I've seen pictures. This church used to be a hustling, bustling church. It's been here for 173 years. It used to be filled up. There's one picture of kids out front. And I couldn't even count how many kids there were. But it was the whole front of the building. 5, 6, am I right? 7, 8 rows deep of kids. This place used to be filled up with kids. And what the scripture is telling us here is that when you get about the fast that I'm about, then I'll rebuild your house. and you'll be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of the streets. You see, he's talking to these exiles who have been taken captive in Babylon, knowing that their homeland has been destroyed. Time and time again, God's people had to be taken into captivity because they kept being reminded, oh, it's all about God, and he gives us our home back, and it's all about us. And then we go over here in captivity, and we realize it's all about God, and then we come back home, and it's all about us. And so they're off in captivity, knowing that the walls of their city have been ripped down. And he's saying, when you get about what I'm about, then you'll be restorers of the breach. You'll be the restorers of the street, and I'll send my people back. Your light will shine forth like noonday. So what are we going to do? Are we just going to be happy with 40 people in here this morning? Almost 40 people in here last night? Or are we going to be people about the lostness that surrounds us? Surrounds us. So what can you do? How can you be a part? One, you can get involved. Get involved. There are things that we're doing that you could be doing. The Scotia Cares Ministry, one of the reasons it's not growing and thriving is because John can't do 8 jobs at one time. He can't paint 8 different houses. He is a very talented and great man, but he's limited by just being one person, right? So how can we make a difference in the brokenness of our area? Get involved and then reproduce yourself. Teach someone to do what you're going to do, what you do. Like if we're going to plant churches, then I need to reproduce myself in Vinny and say, Vinny, I see in you the most powerful 4 letters in the alphabet. I see in you the ability to be a shepherd of people. And I'm going to teach you to do what I do. And Jay does the same thing. And then Marianne does the same thing. I teach you to love kids and shepherd them and teach them how to love Jesus and change their life. So get involved and then reproduce yourself. The second thing you can do is support the vision with your dollars. I'm not going to be the kind of pastor that stands up here and asks for your money all the time. I don't want to be that kind of pastor. I watch those kind of pastors on TV, and I don't like them. I'm not saying they're bad people, but I don't want to be like that. I don't want to be that guy. But to do this, it's going to take some money. And so if you're in, reproduce yourself. Get involved, and then teach someone to do what you do. And if you're in, put your money in the plate. We didn't pass the offering this morning because I wanted to talk about this. I'm not trying to trick you into giving. This is the one and only area in the Bible that God says, test me. You can't outgive him. You need to know that I am not going to stand here and tell you that if you put $1,000 in the plate, he's going to give you $10,000. If you want that, you can go home and flip on the television and you can get that. But I'm not telling you that. But what I'm telling you is that when you give, when I decided that I was going to trust God with my money and give him what he asked for, I stopped not paying my bills. I stopped not getting the things that I needed. And guess what? I kept getting some of the things I wanted. I don't know how it happened. We didn't get a raise. But I said, here you go, God. You can have the first 10%. I'm not going to wait to make sure all the bills are paid and give you what's left. But I'm going to give to you first. And somehow, magically, that money seemed to stretch. Now, we did sacrifice. We did, you know, when God gets your heart, you start to do things differently with your money. But don't hear this. Do not hear this morning that if you put money, there's black boxes in the back of the room on your way out the door. 2 in the windows and 1 straight back in the middle. Do not hear me tell you that if you put $100 in there, you're getting $1,000 back. Don't hear that. Hear that you cannot outgive God. Remember the little widow who had 2 mites. And these people came in with their trumpets blaring. I don't know that they really had trumpets blaring. But they came in, puffed up, putting their large amounts in the plate. And they look over at her. can God do with that? She falls on her face and gave everything she had, trusting God to provide. This might be one of the one and only time you hear me tell you to put money in the bucket. But I'm telling you, put money in the bucket. Not so that I can make money. Because God's got some plans. I invited you in. Our knees, and we're going to keep praying that you, God, pour out for the homeless and the hungry and the poor. You saw the numbers. You saw the numbers in the video about poverty in America. You know, the average household income for a family of four is $23,021. The average family of four in America makes less than $25,000. And we could think, man, thanks a lot, government. Thanks a lot, everybody else. Thanks a lot. Or we could step up and say, hey, we're here. We got a food pantry. Come eat. You know what? I got more than enough. Take mine. So what kind of people do we want to be? Do we want to be the top part that comes in here and says, God, we're doing all this grand stuff for you? Or do we want to be people from verse 6 to verse 12 that participate in the fast that God chooses? What are we going to do? Here's what we're going to do. This morning, we are going to sing this song to ask Him to set a fire in our soul that can't be contained, that can't be controlled. So the band is going to come back up. If you're in, if you're a part, you're willing, join in. Stand up and sing. If you're not, that's okay. No pressure. No pressure. We trust God to do with everything that we give Him. So if you're in, let's stand and sing.